21. The next day, Lewis called the intensive care unit at the EMMC. Norma's condition was still listed as critical. That was standard operating procedure for the first 24 hours following a heart attack. Lewis got a cheerier assessment from Weybridge, her doctor, however. "I wouldn't even call it a minor myocardial infarction," he said. "No scarring. Shows you a hell of a lot, Dr. Creed." On impulse, Lewis stopped by the hospital later that week with a bouquet of flowers and found that Norma had been moved to a semi-private room downstairs. A very good sign. Judd was with her. Norma exclaimed over the flowers and buzzed a nurse for a vase. Then she directed Judd until they were in water, arranged to her specifications, and placed on the dresser in the corner. "Mother's feeling ever so much better," Judd said dryly after he had fiddled with the flowers for the third time. "Don't be smart, Judson," Norma said.
"No, ma'am."
At last, Norma looked at Lewis.
"I want to thank you for what you did,"
she said with a shyness that was utterly unaffected and thus doubly touching.
"Judd says I owe you my life."
Embarrassed, Lewis said,
"Judd exaggerates."
"Not very damn much, he don't,"
Judd said. He squinted at Lewis, almost smiling, but not quite.
"Didn't your mother tell you never to slip a thank you, Lewis?"
She hadn't said anything about that, at least not that Lewis could remember, but he believed she had said something once about false modesty being half the sin of pride.
"Norma," he said, "anything I could do, I was pleased to do."
"You're a dear man," Norma said. "You take this man of mine out somewhere and let him buy you a glass of beer. I'm feeling sleepy again, and I can't seem to get rid of him."
Judd stood up with alacrity.
"Hot damn! I'll go for that, Lewis. Quick, before she changes her mind."
The first snow came a week before Thanksgiving. They got another 4 inches on the 22nd of November, but the day before the holiday itself was clear and blue and cold. Lewis took his family to Bangor International Airport and saw them off on the first leg of their trip back to Chicago for a visit with Rachel's parents. "It's not right," Rachel said for perhaps the 20th time since discussions on this matter had commenced in earnest a month ago. "I don't like thinking of you rattling around the house alone on Thanksgiving Day. That's supposed to be a family holiday, Lewis."
Lewis shifted Gage, who looked gigantic and wide-eyed in his first big boy parka, to his other arm.
Ellie was at one of the big windows, watching an Air Force helicopter take off.
"I'm not exactly going to be crying in my beer," Lewis said. "Judd and Norma are going to have me over for turkey and all the trimmings. Hell, I'm the one who feels guilty. I've never liked these big holiday group gropes anyway. I start drinking in front of some football game at 3 p.m. and fall asleep at 7, and the next day it feels like the Dallas Cowgirls are dancing around and yelling Bula Bula inside my head. I just don't like sending you off with the two kids."
"I'll be fine," she said. "Flying first class, I feel like a princess. And Gage will sleep on the flight from Logan to O'Hare."
"You hope," he said, and they both laughed.
The flight was called, and Ellie scampered over.
"That's us, Mommy. Come on, come on, come on. They'll leave without us."
"No, they won't," Rachel said.
She was clutching her three pink boarding cards in one hand. She was wearing her fur coat, some fake stuff that was a luxuriant brown. Probably it was supposed to look like muskrat, Lewis thought. Whatever it was supposed to look like, it made her look absolutely lovely. Perhaps something of what he felt showed in his eyes, because she hugged him impulsively, semi-crushing Gage between them. Gage looked surprised, but not terribly upset.
"Lewis Creed, I love you," she said.
"Mommy," Ellie said, now in a fever of impatience. "Come on, come on. Oh, all right," she said.
"Be good, Lewis."
"Tell you what," he said, grinning. "I'll be careful. Say hello to your folks, Rachel."
"Oh, you," she said, and wrinkled her nose at him.
Rachel was not fooled. She knew perfectly well why Lewis was skipping this trip.
"Funny."
He watched them enter the boarding ramp and disappear from sight for the next week. He already felt homesick and lonely for them. He moved over to the window where Ellie had been, hands stuffed in his coat pockets, watching the baggage handlers loading the hold. The truth was simple. Not only Mr. but also Mrs. Irwin Goldman of Lake Forest had disliked Lewis from the beginning. He came from the wrong side of the tracks, but that was just for starters.
Worse, he fully expected their daughter to support him while he went to medical school, where he would almost surely flunk out. Lewis could have handled all this. In fact, had been doing so. Then something had happened which Rachel did not know about, and never would, not from Lewis anyway. Irwin Goldman had offered to pay Lewis's entire tuition through med school. The price of this scholarship, Goldman's word, was that Lewis should break off his engagement with Rachel at once. Lewis Creed had not been at the optimum time of life to deal with such an outrage, but such melodramatic proposals, or bribes, to call a spade, are rarely made to those who are at an optimum time, which might be around the age of 85. He was tired, for one thing. He was spending 18 hours a week in classes, another 20 hitting the books, another 15 waiting tables in a deep-dish pizza joint down the block from the Whitehall Hotel. He was also nervous. Mr. Goldman's oddly jovial manner that evening had contrasted completely with his previous cold behavior, and Lewis thought that when Goldman invited him into the study for a cigar, a look had passed from him to his wife. Later, much later, when time had lent a little perspective, Lewis would reflect that horses must feel much the same free-floating anxiety when they smell the first smoke of a prairie fire. He began expecting Goldman to reveal at any moment that he knew Lewis had been sleeping with his daughter. When Goldman instead made his incredible offer, even going so far as to take his checkbook from the pocket of his smoking jacket like a rake in a Noel Coward farce, Lewis had blown up. He accused Goldman of trying to keep his daughter like an exhibit in a museum, of having no regard for anyone but himself, and of being an overbearing, thoughtless bastard. It would be a long time before he would admit to himself that part of his rage had been relief. All of these little insights into Irwin Goldman's character, though perhaps true, had no redeeming touch of diplomacy in them. Any semblance of Noel Coward departed. If there was humor in the rest of the conversation, it was of a much more vulgar sort. Goldman told him to get out, and that if he ever saw Lewis on his doorstep again, he would shoot him like a yellow dog. Lewis told Goldman to take his checkbook and plug up his ass with it. Goldman said he had seen bums in the gutter who had more potential than Lewis Creed. Lewis told Goldman he could also shove his goddamn Bank America card and his American Express gold card right up there beside his checkbook. None of this had been a promising first step toward good relations with the future in-laws. In the end, Rachel had brought them around. After each man had had a chance to repent of the things he had said, although neither of them had ever changed his mind in the slightest about the other, there was no more melodrama, certainly no dismally theatrical, "from this day forward I have no daughter" scene. Goldman would have probably suffered through Rachel's marriage to the creature from the Black Lagoon before denying her. Nevertheless, the face rising above the collar of Irwin Goldman's morning coat on the day Lewis married Rachel had greatly resembled the faces sometimes seen carved on Egyptian sarcophagi. Their wedding present had been a six-place setting of Spode china and a microwave oven. No money. For most of Lewis's harum-scarum med school days, Rachel had worked as a clerk in a women's apparel store. And from that day to this day, Rachel only knew that things had been and continued to be tense between her husband and her parents, particularly between Lewis and her father. Lewis could have gone to Chicago with his family, although the university schedule would have meant flying back 3 days earlier than Rachel and the kids. That was no great hardship. On the other hand, 4 days with Imhotep and his wife the Sphinx would have been. The children had melted his in-laws a good deal, as children often do. Lewis suspected that he himself could have completed the rapprochement simply by pretending he had forgotten that evening in Goldman's study. It wouldn't even matter that Goldman knew he was pretending. But the fact was, and he at least had the guts to be up front about it with himself, that he did not quite want to make the rapprochement. 10 years was a long time, but it was not quite long enough to take away the slimy taste that had come into his mouth when in Goldman's study over glasses of brandy. The old man had opened one side of that idiotic smoking jacket and removed the checkbook residing within. Yes, he had felt relief that the nights, 5 of them in all, that he and Rachel had spent in his narrow, sagging apartment bed had not been discovered. But that surprised disgust had been quite its own thing, and the years between then and now had not changed it.
He could have come, but he preferred to send his father-in-law, his grandchildren, his daughter, and a message. The Delta 727 pulled away from the rampway, turned, and he saw Ellie at one of the front windows, waving frantically. Lewis waved back, smiling, and then someone, Ellie or Rachel, hiked Gage into the window. Lewis waved, and Gage waved back, perhaps seeing him, perhaps only imitating Ellie. "Fly my people safe," he muttered, then zipped his coat and went out to the parking lot. Here the wind whined and zoomed with force enough to almost tear his hunter's cap off his head, and he clapped a hand to it. He fumbled with his keys to unlock the driver's side door of his car, and then turned as the jet rose beyond the terminal building, its nose tilted upward into the hard blue, its turbos thundering. Feeling very lonely indeed now, ridiculously close to tears, Lewis waved again. He was still feeling blue that evening when he recrossed Route 15 after a couple of beers with Judd and Norma. Norma had drunk a glass of wine, something she was allowed, even encouraged to have, by Dr. Weybridge. They had moved into the kitchen tonight in deference to the season. Judd had stoked up the small Merrick stove, and they had sat around it, the beer cold, the heat good, and Judd had talked about how the Mi'kmaq Indians had staved off a British landing at Machias 200 years ago. In those days, the Mi'kmaqs had been pretty fearsome, he said, and then added that he guessed there were a few state and federal land lawyers who thought they still were. It should have been a fine evening, but Lewis was aware of the empty house waiting for him. Crossing the lawn and feeling the frost crunching under his shoes, he heard the telephone begin to ring in the house. He broke into a run, got through the front door, sprinted through the living room, knocking over a magazine stand, and then slid most of the way across the kitchen, his frosty shoes skidding over the linoleum. He snared the phone. "Hello? Lewis?" Rachel's voice, a little distant but absolutely fine. "We're here. We made it. No problems." "Great," he said, and sat down to talk to her, thinking, "I wish to God you were here." 22. The Thanksgiving dinner Judd and Norma put on was a fine one. When it was over, Lewis went home feeling full and sleepy. He went upstairs to the bedroom, relishing the quiet a little, flipped off his loafers, and lay down. It was just after 3 o'clock. The day outside was lit with thin, wintry sunshine. "I'll just doze a little," he thought, and fell fast asleep. It was the bedroom extension that woke him up. He groped for it, trying to pull himself together, disoriented by the fact that it was almost dark outside. He could hear the wind whining around the corners of the house and the faint, husky mutter of the furnace. "Hello," he said. It would be Rachel calling from Chicago again to wish him a happy Thanksgiving. She would put Ellie on, and Ellie would talk, and then Gage would get on, and Gage would babble. And how the hell had he managed to sleep all afternoon when he had meant to watch the football game? But it wasn't Rachel. It was Judd. "Lewis, afraid maybe you've got a little spot of trouble." He swung out of bed, still trying to scrub the sleep out of his mind. "Judd, what trouble?" "Well, there's a dead cat over here on our lawn," Judd said. "I think it might be your daughter's." "Church?" Lewis asked. There was a sudden sinking in his belly. "Are you sure, Judd?" "No, I ain't 100% sure," Judd said. "But it sure looks like him." Oh, shit. "I'll be right over, Judd." "All right, Lewis." He hung up and just sat there for a minute longer. Then he went in and used the bathroom, put his shoes on, and went downstairs. "Oh, maybe it isn't church." Judd himself said he wasn't 100% sure. Christ, the cat doesn't even want to go upstairs anymore unless someone carries him. Why would he cross the road? But in his heart he felt that it was church. And if Rachel called this evening, as she almost certainly would, what was he going to say to Ellie? Crazily, he heard himself saying to Rachel, "I know that anything, literally anything, can happen to physical beings. As a doctor, I know that. Do you want to be the one to explain to her what happened if he gets run over in the road?" But he hadn't really believed anything was going to happen to church, had he? He remembered one of the guys he played poker with, Wicks Sullivan, asking him once how he could get horny for his wife and not get horny for the naked women he saw day in and day out. Lewis had tried to explain to him that it wasn't the way people imagined in their fantasies.
A woman coming in to get a pap smear or to learn how to give herself a breast self-examination didn't suddenly drop a sheet and stand there like Venus on the half shell. You saw a breast, a vulva, a thigh. The rest was draped in a sheet. And there was a nurse in attendance, more to protect the doctor's reputation than anything else. Wiki wasn't buying it. A tit is a tit, was Wiki's thesis, and a twat is a twat. You should either be horny all the time or none of the time. All Lewis could respond was that your wife's tit was different. Just like your family's supposed to be different, he thought now. Church wasn't supposed to get killed because he was inside the magic circle of the family. What he hadn't been able to make Wiki understand was that doctors compartmentalized just as cheerfully and blindly as anyone else. A tit wasn't a tit unless it was your wife's tit. In the office, a tit was a case. You could stand up in front of a medical colloquium and cite leukemia figures and children until you were blue in the face and still not believe it if one of your own kids got a call on the bone phone. My kid? My kid's cat, even? Doctor, you must be joking. Never mind. Take this one step at a time. But that was hard when he remembered how hysterical Ellie had gotten at the prospect of Church someday dying. Stupid fucking cat. Why did we ever have to get a fucking cat anyway? But he wasn't fucking anymore. That was supposed to keep him alive. Church, he called. But there was only the furnace, muttering and muttering, burning up dollars. The couch in the living room, where Church had recently spent most of his time, was empty. He was not lying on any of the radiators. Lewis rattled the cat's dish, the one thing absolutely guaranteed to bring Church running if he was in earshot. But no cat came running this time. And never would again, he was afraid. He put on his coat and hat and started for the door. Then he came back. Giving in to what his heart told him, he opened the cupboard under the sink and squatted down. There were two kinds of plastic bags in there, small white ones for the household trash baskets, and big green garbage can liners. Lewis took one of the latter. Church had put on weight since he had been fixed. He poked the bag into one of the side pockets of his jacket, not liking the slick, cool way the plastic felt under his fingers. Then he let himself out the front door and crossed the street to Judd's house. It was about 5:30. Twilight was ending. The landscape had a dead look. The remainder of sunset was a strange orange line on the horizon across the river. The wind bowled straight down Route 15, numbing Lewis's cheeks and whipping away the white plume of his breath. He shuddered, but not from the cold. It was a feeling of aloneness that made him shudder. It was strong and persuasive. There seemed no way to concretize it with a metaphor. It was faceless. He just felt by himself, untouched and untouching. He saw Judd across the road, bundled up in his big green duffel coat, his face lost in the shadow cast by the fur-fringed hood. Standing on his frozen lawn, he looked like a piece of statuary, just another dead thing in this twilight landscape where no birds sang. Lewis started across, and then Judd moved, waved him back, shouted something Lewis could not make out over the pervasive whine of the wind. Lewis stepped back, realizing suddenly that the wind's whine had deepened and sharpened. A moment later, an air horn blatted, and an Orinco truck roared past, close enough to make his pants and jacket flap. Damned if he hadn't almost walked right out in front of the thing. This time he checked both ways before crossing. There was only the tanker's taillights, dwindling into the twilight. "Thought that Orinco truck was going to get you," Judd said. "Have a care, Lewis." Even this close, Lewis couldn't see Judd's face, and the uncomfortable feeling persisted that this could have been anyone. Anyone at all. "Where's Norma?" he asked, still not looking down at the sprawled bundle of fur by Judd's foot. "Went to the Thanksgiving church service," he said. "She'll stay to the supper, I guess, although I don't think she'll eat nothing. She's gotten peckish." The wind gusted, shifting the hood back momentarily, and Lewis saw that it was indeed Judd. Who else would it have been? "It's mostly an excuse for a hen patty," Judd said. "They don't eat much but sandwiches after the big meal at noon. She'll be back around 8. Lewis knelt down to look at the cat. "Don't let it be Church," he wished fervently, as he turned its head gently on its neck with gloved fingers. "Let it be someone else's cat. Let Judd be wrong." But of course it was Church. He was in no way mangled or disfigured. He had not been run over by one of the big tankers or semis that cruised Route 15. Just what was that Orenco truck doing out on Thanksgiving, he wondered randomly. Church's eyes were half open, as glazed as green marbles. A small flow of blood had come from his mouth, which was also open. Not a great deal of blood, just enough to stain the white bib on his chest. Yours, Lewis?
Mine, he agreed and sighed.
He was aware for the first time that he had loved Church, maybe not as fervently as Ellie, but in his own absent way. In the weeks following his castration, Church had changed, had gotten fat and slow, had established a routine that took him between Ellie's bed, the couch, and his dish, but rarely out of the house. Now, in death, he looked to Lewis like the old Church, the mouth so small and bloody, filled with needle-sharp cat's teeth, was frozen in a shooter's snarl. The dead eyes seemed furious. It was as if, after the short and placid stupidity of his life as a neuter, Church had rediscovered his real nature in dying.
"Yeah, it's Church," he said. "I'll be damned if I know how I'm going to tell Ellie about it."
Suddenly he had an idea. He would bury Church up in the pet cemetery with no marker or any of that foolishness. He would say nothing to Ellie on the phone tonight about Church. Tomorrow he would mention casually that he hadn't seen Church around. The day after he would suggest that perhaps Church had wandered off. Cats did that sometimes. Ellie would be upset, sure, but there would be none of the finality, no reprise of Rachel's upsetting refusal to deal with death, just a withering away.
Coward, part of his mind pronounced. Yes, no argument, but who needs this hassle?
"Loves that cat pretty well, doesn't she?" Judd asked.
"Yes," Lewis said absently.
He moved Church's head again. The cat had begun to stiffen, but the head still moved much more easily than it should have. "Broken neck."
"Yeah."
Given that, he thought he could reconstruct what had happened. Church had been crossing the road, for what reason God alone knew, and a car or a truck had hit him, breaking his neck and throwing him aside onto Judd Crandall's lawn. Or perhaps the cat's neck had been broken when he struck the frozen ground. It didn't matter. Either way, the remains remained the same. Church was dead. He glanced up at Judd, about to tell him his conclusions, but Judd was looking away toward that fading orange line of light at the horizon. His hood had fallen back halfway, and his face seemed thoughtful and stern. Harsh, even. Lewis pulled the green garbage bag out of his pocket and unfolded it, holding it tightly to keep the wind from whipping it away. The brisk, crackling sound of the bag seemed to bring Judd back to this here and now.
"Yes, I guess she loves it pretty well," Judd said.
His use of the present tense felt slightly eerie. The whole setting, with the fading light, the cold, and the wind, struck him as eerie and gothic.
"Here's Heathcliff out on the desolate moors," Lewis thought, grimacing against the cold. "Getting ready to pop the family cat into a hefty bag. Yowza."
He grabbed Church's tail, spread the mouth of the bag, and lifted the cat. He pulled a disgusted, unhappy face at the sound the cat's body made coming up, rip, as he pulled it out of the frost it had set into. The cat seemed almost unbelievably heavy, as if death had settled into it like a physical weight.
"Christ, he feels like a bucket of sand."
Judd held the other side of the bag, and Lewis dropped Church in, glad to be rid of that strange, unpleasant weight.
"What are you going to do with it now?" Judd asked.
"Put him in the garage, I guess," Lewis said. "Bury him in the morning."
"In the pet cemetery?"
Lewis shrugged.
"Suppose so. Going to tell Ellie?"
I'll have to mull that one over a while." Judd was quiet a moment longer, and then he seemed to reach a decision.
"Wait here a minute or two, Lewis."
Judd moved away, with no apparent thought that Lewis might not want to wait just another minute on this bitter night. He moved away with assurance, and that lithe ease which was so strange in a man of his age, and Lewis found he had nothing to say anyway. He didn't feel much like himself. He watched Judd go, quite content to stand here. He raised his face into the wind after the door had clicked closed, the garbage bag with Church's body in it riffling between his feet. Content. Yes, he was. For the first time since they had moved to Maine, he felt that he was in his place, that he was home. Standing here by himself in the afterglow of the day, standing on the rim of winter, he felt unhappy and yet oddly exhilarated and strangely whole. Whole in a way he had not been, or could not remember feeling that he had been since childhood. Something gonna happen here, Bubba. Something pretty weird, I think. He tilted his head back and saw cold winter stars in a blackening sky. How long he stood like that, he did not know, although it could not have been long in terms of seconds and minutes. Then a light flickered on Judd's porch, bobbed, approached the porch door, and descended the steps. It was Judd behind a big four-cell flashlight. In his other hand, he held what Lewis at first thought was a large X, and then he saw that it was a pick and shovel. He handed the shovel to Lewis, who took it in his free hand. "Judd, what the hell are you up to? We can't bury him tonight." "Yeah, we can. And we're gonna." Judd's face was lost behind the glaring circle of the flashlight. "Judd, it's dark. It's late. And cold. Come on," Judd said. "Let's get it done." Lewis shook his head and tried to begin again, but the words came hard, the words of explanation and reason. They seemed so meaningless against the low shriek of the wind, the seedling bed of stars in the black. "It can wait till tomorrow when we can see..." "Does she love the cat?" "Yes, but..." Judd's voice, soft and somehow logical. "And do you love her?" "Of course I love her. She's my daughter." "Then come on." Lewis went. Twice, maybe three times, on the walk up to the pet cemetery that night, Lewis tried to talk to Judd, but Judd didn't answer. Lewis gave up. That feeling of contentment, odd under the circumstances, but a pure fact, persisted. It seemed to come from everywhere. The steady ache in his muscles from carrying Church in one hand and the shovel in the other was a part of it. The wind, deadly cold, numbing exposed skin, was a part of it. It wound steadily in the trees. Once they got into the woods, there was no snow to speak of. The bobbing light of Judd's flash was a part of it. He felt the pervasive, undeniable, magnetic presence of some secret. Some dark secret. The shadows fell away, and there was a feeling of space. Snow shone pallidly. "Rest here," Judd said, and Lewis set the bag down. He wiped sweat off his forehead with his arm. Rest here? But they were here. He could see the markers in the moving, aimless sweep of Judd's light as Judd sat down in the thin snow and put his face between his arms. "Judd, are you all right?" "Fine. Need to catch my breath a bit, that's all." Lewis sat down next to him and deep-breathed half a dozen times. "You know," he said, "I feel better than I have in maybe 6 years. I know that's a crazy thing to say when you're burying your daughter's cat, but it's the flat truth, Judd. I feel good." Judd breathed deeply once or twice himself. "Yeah, I know," he said. "It is that way once in a while. You don't pick your times for feeling good any more than you do for the other. And the place has something to do with it, too, but you don't want to trust that. Heroin makes dope addicts feel good when they're putting it in their arms. But all the time it's poisoning them. Poisoning their bodies and poisoning their way of thinking. This place can be like that, Lewis. And don't you ever forget it. I hope to God I'm doing right. I think I am. But I can't be sure. Sometimes my head gets muddled. It's senility coming, I think." "I don't know what you're talking about." "This place has power, Lewis. Not so much here, but... the place we're going, Judd. Come on," Judd said, and was on his feet again. The flashlight's beam illuminated the deadfall. Judd was walking toward it. Lewis suddenly remembered his episode of somnambulism. What was it Pascal had said in the dream that had accompanied it? "Don't go beyond, no matter how much you feel you need to, Doctor. The barrier was not made to be broken." But now, tonight, That dream or warning or whatever it had been seemed years rather than months distant. Lewis felt fine and fey and alive, ready to cope with anything, and yet full of wonder. It occurred to him that this was very much like a dream. Then Judd turned toward him. The hood seemed to surround a blankness, and for one moment Lewis imagined that it was Pascal himself who now stood before him, that the shining light would be reversed, trained on a grinning, gibbering skull framed in fur, and his fear returned like a dash of cold water. "Judd," he said, "we can't climb over that. We'll each break a leg and then probably freeze to death trying to get back." "Just follow me," Judd said. "Follow me and don't look down. Don't hesitate and don't look down. I know the way through, but it has to be done quick and sure." Lewis began to think that perhaps it was a dream, that he had simply never awakened from his afternoon nap. "If I was awake," he thought, "I'd no more head up that deadfall than I'd get drunk and go skydiving. But I'm going to do it. I really think I am. So, I must be dreaming, right?" Judd angled slightly left, away from the center of the deadfall. The flash's beam centered brightly on the jumbled heap of bones, fallen trees, and old logs. The circle of light grew smaller and even brighter as they approached. Without the slightest pause, without even a brief scan to assure himself that he was in the right place, Judd started up. He did not scramble. He did not climb bent over, the way a man will climb a rocky hillside or a sandy slope. He simply mounted as if climbing a set of stairs. He walked like a man who knows exactly where his next step is coming from. Lewis followed in the same way. He did not look down or search for footholds. It came to him with a strange but total surety that the deadfall could not harm him unless he allowed it to. It was a piece of utter assholery, of course, like the stupid confidence of a man who believes it's safe to drive when totally shit-faced as long as he's wearing his St. Christopher's medallion. But it worked. There was no pistol-shot snap of an old branch giving way, no sickening plunge into a hole lined with jutting weather-whitened splinters, each one ready to cut and gore and mangle. His shoes, hush-puppy loafers, hardly recommended for climbing deadfalls, did not slip on the old dry moss which had overgrown many of the fallen trees. He pitched neither forward nor backward. The wind sang wildly through the fir trees all around them. For a moment he saw Judd standing on top of the deadfall, and then he began down the far side, calves dropping out of sight, then thighs, then hips and waist. The light bounced randomly off the whipping branches of the trees on the other side of the barrier. Yes, that's what it was. Why try to pretend it wasn't? The barrier. Lewis reached the top himself and paused there momentarily. Right foot planted on an old fallen tree that was canted up at a 35-degree angle, left foot on something springier, a mesh of old fir branches. He didn't look down to see, but only switched the heavy trash bag with Church's body in it from his right hand to his left, exchanging it for the lighter shovel. He turned his face up into the wind and felt it sweep past him in an endless current, lifting his hair. It was so cold, so clean, so constant. Moving casually, almost sauntering, he started down again. Once a branch that felt to be the thickness of a brawny man's wrist snapped loudly under his foot, but he felt no concern at all, and his plunging foot was stopped firmly by a heavier branch some 4 inches down. Lewis hardly staggered. He supposed that now he could understand how company commanders in World War I had been able to stroll along the top of the trenches with bullets snapping all around them, whistling Tipperary. It was crazy, but the very craziness made it tremendously exhilarating. He walked down, looking straight ahead at the bright circle of Judd's light. Judd was standing there, waiting for him. Then he reached the bottom, and the exhilaration flared up in him like a shot of coal oil on embers. "We made it!" he shouted. He put the shovel down and clapped Judd on the shoulder. He remembered climbing an apple tree to the top fork where it swayed in the wind like a ship's mast. He had not felt so young or so viscerally alive in 20 years or more. "Judd, we made it." "Did you think we wouldn't?" Judd asked. Lewis opened his mouth to say something. "Think we wouldn't? We're damn lucky we didn't kill ourselves." And then he shut it again. He never really questioned at all, not from the moment Judd approached the deadfall, and he was not worried about getting back over again. "I guess not," he said. "Come on. Got a piece to walk yet. 3 miles or more." They walked. The path did indeed go on. In places it seemed very wide, although the moving light revealed little clearly. It was mostly a feeling of space, a feeling that the trees had drawn back. Once or twice Lewis looked up and saw stars wheeling between the massed, dark border of trees. Once something loped across the path ahead of them, and the light picked up the reflection of greenish eyes. There, and then gone. At other times the path closed in until underbrush scratched stiff fingers across the shoulders of Lewis's coat. He switched the bag and the shovel more often, but the ache in his shoulders was now constant. He fell into a rhythm of walking and became almost hypnotized with it. There was power here, yes, he felt it. He remembered a time when he had been a senior in high school. He and his girl and some other couple had gone way out in the boonies and had ended up necking at the end of a dead-end dirt road near a power station. They hadn't been there long before Lewis's girl said she wanted to go home, or at least to another place, because all her teeth, all the ones with fillings anyway, and that was most of them, were aching. Lewis had been glad to leave himself. The error on the power station had made him feel nervous and too awake. This was like that, but it was stronger. Stronger, but not unpleasant at all. It was... Judd had stopped at the base of a long slope. Lewis ran into him. Judd turned toward him. "We're almost where we're going now," he said calmly. "This next bit is like the deadfall. You got to walk steady and easy. Just follow me and don't look down." "You felt us going downhill?" "Yes." "This is the edge of what the Micmacs used to call Little God Swamp. The fur traders who came through called it Dead Man's Bog. And most of them who came once and got out never came again."
"Is there quicksand?"
"Oh, aye. Quicksand aplenty. Streams that bubble up through a big deposit of quartz sand left over from the glacier. Silica sand, we always called it, although there's probably a proper name for it."
Judd looked at him, and for a moment Lewis thought he saw something bright and not completely pleasant in the old man's eyes. Then Judd shifted the flashlight, and that look was gone.
"There's a lot of funny things down this way, Lewis. The air's heavier. More electrical, or something."
Lewis started.
"What's wrong?"
"Nothing," Lewis said, thinking of that night on the dead-end road.
"You might see St. Elmo's fire. What the sailors call foo lights. It makes funny shapes, but it's nothing. If you should see some of those shapes and they bother you, just look the other way. You may hear sounds like voices. But they are the loons down south toward Prospect. The sound carries. It's funny."
"Loons?" Lewis said doubtfully. "This time of year?"
"Oh, yeah," Judd said again. And his voice was terribly bland and totally unreadable. For a moment Lewis wished desperately he could see the old man's face again. That look.
"Judd, where are we going? What the hell are we doing out here in the back of the beyond?"
"I'll tell you when we get there."
Judd turned away.
"Mind the tussocks."
They began to walk again, stepping from one broad hummock to the next. Lewis did not feel for them. His feet seemed to find them automatically with no effort from him. He slipped only once, his left shoe breaking through a thin scum of ice and dipping into cold and somehow slimy standing water. He pulled it out quickly and went on, following Judd's bobbing light. That light, floating through the woods, brought back memories of the pirate tales he had liked to read as a boy. Evil men off to bury gold doubloons by the dark of the moon. And, of course, one of them would be tumbled into the pit on top of the chest, a bullet in his heart, because the pirates had believed, or so the authors of these lurid tales solemnly attested, that the dead comrade's ghost would remain there to guard the swag. "Except it's not treasure we've come to bury, just my daughter's castrated cat." He felt wild laughter bubble up inside and stifled it. He did not hear any sounds like voices, nor did he see any St. Elmo's fire.
but after stepping over half a dozen tussocks, he looked down and saw that his feet, calves, knees, and lower thighs had disappeared into a ground fog that was perfectly smooth, perfectly white, and perfectly opaque. It was like moving through the world's lightest drift of snow. The air seemed to have a quality of light in it now, and it was warmer. He could have sworn it. He could see Judd before him, moving steadily along, the blunt end of the pick hooked over his shoulder. The pick enhanced the illusion of a man intent on burying treasure. That crazy sense of exhilaration persisted, and he suddenly wondered if maybe Rachel was trying to call him. If, back in the house, the phone was ringing and ringing, making its rational, prosaic sound. If... He almost walked into Judd's back again. The old man had stopped in the middle of the path. His head was cocked to one side. His mouth was pursed and tense. "Judd, what's..."
"Shh."
Lewis hushed, looking around uneasily. Here the ground mist was thinner, but he still couldn't see his own shoes. Then he heard crackling underbrush and breaking branches. Something was moving out there. Something big. He opened his mouth to ask Judd if it was a moose. Bear was the thought that actually crossed his mind. And then he closed it again. "The sound carries," Judd had said. He cocked his head to one side in unconscious imitation of Judd, unaware that he was doing it, and listened. The sound seemed at first distant, then very close, moving away and then moving ominously toward them. Lewis felt the sweat on his forehead begin to trickle down his chapped cheeks. He shifted the hefty bag with Church's body in it from one hand to the other. His palm had dampened, and the green plastic seemed greasy, wanting to slide through his fist. Now the thing out there seemed so close that Lewis expected to see its shape at any moment, rising up on two legs, perhaps, blotting out the star that was some unthought-of immense and shaggy body. Bear was no longer what he was thinking of. Now he didn't know just what he was thinking of. Then it moved away and disappeared. Lewis opened his mouth again, the words, "What was that?" already on his tongue. Then a shrill, maniacal laugh came out of the darkness, rising and falling in hysterical cycles, loud, piercing, chilling. To Lewis it seemed that every joint in his body had frozen solid, and that he had somehow gained weight, so much weight that if he turned to run, he would plunge down and out of sight in the swampy ground. The laughter rose, split into dry cackles like some rottenly friable chunk of rock along many fault lines. It reached the pitch of a scream, then sank into a guttural chuckling that might have become sobs before it faded out altogether. Somewhere there was a drip of water, and above them, like a steady river in a bed of sky, the monotonous whine of the wind. Otherwise, little God Swamp was silent. Lewis began to shudder all over. His flesh, particularly that of his lower belly, began to creep. Yes, creep was the right word. His flesh actually seemed to be moving on his body. His mouth was totally dry. There seemed to be no spit at all left in it. Yet, that feeling of exhilaration persisted, an unshakable lunacy. "What in Christ's name?" he whispered hoarsely to Judd. Judd turned to look at him. In the dim light, Lewis thought the old man looked 120. There was no sign of that odd dancing light in his eyes now. His face was drawn, and there was stark terror in his eyes. But when he spoke, his voice was steady enough. "Just a loon," he said. "Come on. Almost there." They went on. The tussocks became firm ground again. For a few moments, Lewis had a sensation of open space, although that dim glow in the air had now faded, and it was all he could do to make out Judd's back 3 feet in front of him. Short grass, stiff with frost, was underfoot. It broke like glass at every step. Then they were in the trees again. He could smell aromatic fir, feel needles, occasionally a twig or a branch scraped against him. Lewis had lost all sense of time or direction, but they did not walk long before Judd stopped again and turned toward him. "Steps here," he said, "cut into rock. 42 or 44, I disremember which. Just follow me. We get to the top, and we're there." He began to climb again, and Lewis followed. The stone steps were wide enough, but the sense of the ground dropping away was unsettling. Here and there his shoe gritted on a strew of pebbles and stone fragments. 12. 13. 14. The wind was sharper, colder, quickly numbing his face. Are we above the tree line? He wondered. He looked up and saw a billion stars, cold lights in the darkness. Never in his life had the stars made him feel so completely small, infinitesimal, without meaning. He asked himself the old question, is there anything intelligent out there? And instead of wonder, the thought brought a horrid, cold feeling, as if he had asked himself what it might be like to eat a handful of squirming bugs. 26, 27, 28. Who carved these, anyway? Indians? The Micmacs? Were they tool-bearing Indians? I'll have to ask Judd. Tool-bearing Indians made him think of fur-bearing animals, and that made him think of that thing that had been moving near them in the woods. One foot stumbled, and he raked a gloved hand along the rock wall to his left for balance. The wall felt old, chipped and channeled and wrinkled, like dry skin that's almost worn out, he thought. You all right, Lewis? Judd murmured. I'm okay, he said, although he was nearly out of breath and his muscles throbbed with the weight of church in the bag. 42, 43, 44. 45, Judd said. I've forgot. Haven't been up here in 12 years, I guess. Don't suppose I'll ever have a reason to come again. Here, up you come and up you get. He grabbed Lewis's arm and helped him up the last step. We're here, Judd said. Lewis looked around. He could see well enough. The starlight was dim, but adequate. They were standing on a rocky, rubble-strewn plate of rock which slid out of the thin earth directly ahead like a dark tongue. Looking the other way, he could see the tops of the fir trees they had come through in order to reach the steps. They'd apparently climbed to the top of some weird, flat-topped mesa, a geological anomaly that would have seemed far more normal in Arizona or New Mexico. Because the grass over top of the mesa, or hill, or truncated mountain, or whatever it was bare of trees, the sun had melted the snow here. Turning back to Judd, Lewis saw dry grasses bending before the steady wind that blew coldly in his face, and saw that it was a hill, not an isolated mesa. Ahead of him, the ground rose again toward trees. But this flatness was so obvious and so odd in the context of New England's low and somehow tired hills. Tool-bearing Indians, his mind suddenly spoke up. Come on, Judd said, and led him 25 yards toward the trees. The wind blew hard up here, but it felt clean. Lewis saw a number of shapes just under the gloom cast by the trees, trees which were the oldest, tallest firs he had ever seen. The whole effect of this high, lonely place was emptiness, but an emptiness which vibrated. The dark shapes were cairns of stones. Micmac sent it off the top of the hill here, Judd said. No one knows how, no more than anyone knows how the Mayans built their pyramids. And the Micmacs have forgot themselves, just like the Mayans have. Why? Why did they do it? This was their burying ground, Judd said. I brought you here so you could bury Ellie's cat here. The Micmacs didn't discriminate, you know. They buried their pets right alongside their owners. This made Lewis think of the Egyptians, who had grown that one better. They had slaughtered the pets of royalty so that the souls of the pets might go along to whatever afterlife there might be with the souls of their masters. He remembered reading about the slaughter of more than 10,000 domestic animals following the decease of one pharaoh's daughter. Included in the tally had been 600 pigs and 2,000 peacocks. The pigs had been scented with attar of roses, the dead lady's favorite perfume, before their throats were cut. And they built pyramids, too. No one knows for sure what the Mayan pyramids are for. Navigation and chronography, some say, like Stonehenge. But we know damn well what the Egyptian pyramids were and are. Great monuments to death, the world's biggest gravestones. Here lies Ramses II. He was obedient, Lewis thought, and uttered a wild, helpless cackle. Judd looked at him, unsurprised. Go on and bury your animal, he said. I'm going to have a smoke. I'd help you, but you got to do it yourself. Each buries his own. That's the way it was done then. Judd, what's this all about? Why did you bring me here? Because you saved Norma's life, Judd said. and although he sounded sincere, and Lewis was positive he believed himself sincere, he had a sudden overpowering sense that the man was lying, or that he was being lied to and then passing the lie on to Lewis. He remembered that look he had seen, or thought he had seen, in Judd's eye. But up here, none of that seemed to matter. The wind mattered more, pushing freely around him in that steady river, lifting his hair from his brow and off his ears. Judd sat down with his back against one of the trees, cupped his hands around a match, and lit a Chesterfield. "You want to rest a bit before you start?" "No, I'm okay," Lewis said. He could have pursued the questions, but he found he didn't really care to. This felt wrong, but it also felt right, and he decided to let that be enough. For now, there was really only one thing he needed to know. "Will I really be able to dig him a grave? The soil looks thin." Lewis nodded toward the place where the rock pushed out of the ground at the edge of the steps. Judd nodded slowly. "Yeah," he said. "Soil's thin, all right. But soil deep enough to grow grass in is generally deep enough to bury in, Lewis. And people have been burying here for a long, long time. You won't find it any too easy, though." Nor did he. The ground was stony and hard, and very quickly he saw that he was going to need the pick to dig the grave deep enough to hold church. So he began to alternate, first using the pick to loosen the hard earth and stones, then the shovel to dig out what he had loosened. His hands began to hurt. His body began to warm up again. He felt a strong, unquestionable need to do a good job. He began to hum under his breath, something he sometimes did when suturing a wound. Sometimes the pick would strike a rock hard enough to flash sparks, and the shiver would travel up the wooden shaft to vibrate in his hands. He could feel blisters forming on his palms and didn't care, although he was, like most doctors, usually careful of his hands. Above and around him, the wind sang and sang, playing a tree-note melody. Counterpointing this, he heard the soft drop and chunk of rock. He looked over his shoulder and saw Judd, hunkered down and pulling out the bigger rocks he had dug up, making a heap of them. "For your cairn," he said when he saw Lewis looking. "Oh," Lewis said, and went back to work. He made the grave about 2 feet wide and 3 feet long. "A Cadillac of a grave for a damn cat," he thought. And when it was perhaps 30 inches deep, and the pick was flashing sparks up from almost every stroke, he tossed it and the shovel aside and asked Judd if it was okay. Judd got up and took a cursory look. "Seems fine to me," he said. "Anyway, it's what you think that counts." "Will you tell me now what this is all about?" Judd smiled a little. "The Micmacs believed this hill was a magic place," he said. "Believed this whole forest, from the swamp on north and east, was magic. They made this place, and they buried their dead here, away from everything else. Other tribes steered clear of it. The Penobscots said these woods were full of ghosts. Later on, the fur trappers started saying pretty much the same thing. I suppose some of them saw the Foo Fire and Little God's Swamp and thought they were seeing ghosts." Judd smiled, and Lewis thought, "That isn't what you think at all. Later on, not even the Micmacs themselves would come here. One of them claimed he saw a Wendigo here and that the ground had gone sour. They had a big powwow about it, or so I heard the tale in my green years, Lewis. But I heard it from that old tosspot Stanny B, which is what we all call Stanley Bouchard. And what Stanny B didn't know, he'd make up." Lewis, who knew only that the Wendigo was supposed to be a spirit of the North Country, said, "Do you think the ground's gone sour?" Judd smiled, or at least his lips slanted. "I think it's a dangerous place," he said softly. "But not for cats or dogs or pet hamsters. Go on and bury your animal, Lewis." Lewis lowered the hefty bag into the hole and slowly shoveled the dirt back in. He was cold now and tired. The patter of the earth on the plastic was a depressing sound, and while he did not regret coming up here, that sense of exhilaration was fading, and he'd begun to wish the adventure over. It was a long walk back home. The pattering sound muffled, then stopped. There was only the whump of dirt on more dirt. He scraped the last bit into the hole with the blade of his shovel. There's never enough, he thought, recalling something his undertaker uncle had said to him at least 1,000 years ago. Never enough to fill the hole up again. And then turned to Judd.
Your cairn, Judd said.
Look, Judd, I'm pretty tired, and it's Ellie's cat, Judd said, and his voice, although soft, was implacable. She'd want you to do it right. Lewis sighed.
I suppose she would, he said.
It took another 10 minutes to pile up the rocks Judd handed him, one by one. When it was done, there was a low, conical pile of stones on Church's grave, and Lewis did indeed feel a small, tired pleasure. It looked right, somehow, rising with the others in the starlight. He supposed Ellie would never see it. The thought of taking her through that patch of swamp where there was quicksand would make Rachel's hair turn white. But he had seen it, and it was good.
Most of these have fallen over, he said to Judd, standing and brushing at the knees of his pants.
He was seeing more clearly now, and in several places he could clearly make out scattered strews of loose stones. But Judd had seen to it that he built his own cairn only from stones taken from the grave he himself had dug.
Yeah, Judd said. Told you. The place is old.
Are we done now?
Yeah.
He clapped Lewis on the shoulder.
You did good, Lewis. I knew you would. Let's go home.
Judd, he began, but Judd only grabbed the pick and walked off toward the steps. Lewis got the shovel, had to trot to catch up, and then saved his breath for walking. He looked back once, but the cairn marking the grave of his daughter's cat, Winston Churchill, had melted into the shadows, and he could not pick it out.
We just ran the film backward, Lewis thought tiredly as they emerged from the woods and into the field overlooking his own house some time later.
He did not know how much later. He had taken off his watch when he had lain down to doze that afternoon, and it would still be there on the windowsill by his bed. He only knew that he was beat, used up, done in. He could not remember feeling so kicked dog-weary since his first day on Chicago's rubbish disposal crew one high school summer 16 or 17 years ago. They came back the same way they had gone, but he could remember very little about the trip. He stumbled on the deadfall, he remembered that, lurching forward and thinking absurdly of Peter Pan. Oh, Jesus, I lost my happy thoughts, and down I come. And then Judd's hand had been there, firm and hard. And a few moments later, they had been trudging past the final resting places of Smucky the Cat, and Trixie, and Marta, our pet rabbit, and onto the path he had once walked, not only with Judd, but with his whole family. It seemed that in some weary way he had pondered the dream of Victor Pascal, the one which had resulted in his somnambulistic episode. But any connection between that night walk and this had eluded him. It had also occurred to him that the whole adventure had been dangerous, not in any melodramatic Wilkie Collins sense, but in a very real one, that he had outrageously blistered his hands while in a state that was nearly somnambulistic, was really the least of it. He could have killed himself on the deadfall. Both of them could have. It was hard to square such behavior with sobriety. In his current exhaustion, he was willing to ascribe it to confusion and emotional upset over the death of a pet the whole family had loved. And after a time, there they were, home again. They walked toward it together, not speaking, and stopped again in Lewis's driveway. The wind moaned and whined. Wordlessly, Lewis handed Judd his pick.
I'd best get across, Judd said at last. Luella Bisson or Ruthie Parks will be bringing Norma home, and she'll wonder where the hell I am.
Do you have the time? Lewis asked. He was surprised that Norma wasn't home yet. In his muscles, it seemed to him that midnight must have struck.
Oh, yeah, Judd said. I keep the time as long as I'm dressed, and then I let her go.
He fished a watch out of his pants pocket and flicked the scrolled cover back from its face.
It's gone 8:30, he said, and snapped the cover closed again.
8:30? Lewis repeated stupidly. That's all?
How late did you think it was? Judd asked.
Later than that, Lewis said.
I'll see you tomorrow, Lewis, Judd said and began to move away.
Judd? He turned toward Lewis, mildly questioning.
Judd, what did we do tonight?
Why, we buried your daughter's cat.
Is that all we did?
Nothing but that, Judd said.
You're a good man, Lewis,
but you ask too many questions. Sometimes people have to do things that just seem right. That seem right in their hearts, I mean. And if they do those things, then end up not feeling right. Full of questions and sort of like they got indigestion, only inside their heads instead of in their guts. They think they made a mistake. You know what I mean?
Yes, Lewis said, thinking that Judd must have been reading his mind as the two of them walked downhill through the field and toward the house lights.
What they don't think is that maybe they should be questioning those feelings of doubt before they question their own hearts, Judd said, looking at him closely. What do you think, Lewis?
I think, Lewis said slowly, that you might be right.
And the things that are in a man's heart, it don't do him much good to talk about those things, does it?
Well, no, Judd said, as if Lewis had simply agreed. It don't.
And in his calm voice, that was so sure and so implacable, in that voice which somehow put the chill through Lewis, he said, they are secret things. Women are supposed to be the ones good at keeping secrets, and I guess they do keep a few. But any woman who knows anything at all would tell you she's never really seen into any man's heart. The soil of a man's heart is stonier, Lewis, like the soil up there in the old Micmac burying ground. Bedrock's close. A man grows what he can, and he tends it.
Judd, don't question Lewis. Accept what's done and follow your heart.
But nothing. Accept what's done, Lewis, and follow your heart.
We did what was right this time. At least I hope to Christ it was right. Another time it could be wrong. Wrong as hell.
Will you at least answer one question?
Well, let's hear what it is, and then we'll see.
How did you know about that place?
This question had also occurred to Lewis on the way back, along with the suspicion that Judd himself might be part Micmac, although he did not look like it. He looked as if every one of his ancestors had been 100% card-carrying Anglos.
Why, from Stanny B., he said, looking surprised.
He just told you?
No, Judd said. It isn't the kind of place you just tell somebody about. I buried my dog Spot up there when I was 10. He was chasing a rabbit, and he ran on some rusty barbed wire. The wound's infected, and it killed him.
There was something wrong about that, something that didn't fit with something Lewis had been previously told, but he was too tired to puzzle out the discontinuity. Judd said no more, only looked at him from his inscrutable old man's eyes.
Good night, Judd, Lewis said.
Good night.
The old man crossed the road carrying his pick and shovel.
Thanks, Lewis called impulsively.
Judd didn't turn. He only raised one hand to indicate he had heard. And in the house, suddenly the telephone began to ring.
Lewis ran, wincing at the aches that flared in his upper thighs and lower back, but by the time he had gotten into the warm kitchen, the phone had already rung 6 or 7 times. It stopped ringing just as he put his hand on it. He picked it up anyway and said hello, but there was only the open hum.
That was Rachel, he thought. I'll call her back.
But suddenly it seemed like too much work to dial the number, to dance clumsily with her mother, or worse, her checkbook-brandishing father, to be passed on to Rachel. And then to Ellie. Ellie would still be up, of course. It was an hour earlier in Chicago. Ellie would ask him how Church was doing.
Great, he's fine. Got hit by an Orinco truck. Somehow I am absolutely positive it was an Orinco truck. Anything else would lack dramatic unity, if you know what I mean.
You don't? Well, never mind. The truck killed him, but didn't mark him up hardly at all. Judd and I planted him up in the old Micmac burying ground. Sort of an annex to the pet cemetery, if you know what I mean.
Amazing walk, Punkin. I'll take you up there sometime, and we'll put flowers by his marker. Excuse me, his cairn. After the quicksand's frozen over, that is, and the bears go to sleep for the winter.
He rehung the telephone, crossed to the sink, and filled it with hot water. He removed his shirt and washed. He had been sweating like a pig in spite of the cold, and the pig was exactly what he smelled like. There was some leftover meatloaf in the refrigerator. Lewis cut it into slabs.
put them on a slice of Roman meal bread, and added 2 thick rounds of Bermuda onion. He contemplated this for a moment before dousing it with ketchup and slamming down another slice of bread. If Rachel and Ellie had been around, they would have wrinkled their noses in identical gestures of distaste. Yuck. Gross. Well, you missed it, ladies, Lewis thought with undeniable satisfaction and gobbled his sandwich. It tasted great. Confucius say, he who smells like pig eats like wolf, he thought and smiled. He chased the sandwich with several long swallows of milk directly from the carton, another habit Rachel frowned on strenuously, and then he went upstairs, undressed, and got into bed without even washing his teeth. His aches and pains had faded to one low throb that was almost comforting. His watch was there, where he had left it, and he looked at it. 9:10. It really was incredible. Lewis turned off the light, turned over on his side, and slept. He woke up sometime after 3 the next morning and shuffled to the bathroom. He was standing there urinating, blinking owlishly in the bright white fluorescent bathroom light, when the discrepancy suddenly showed up in his mind, and his eyes widened. It was as if 2 pieces of something which should have fitted together perfectly had instead thudded against one another and rebounded. Tonight, Judd had told him that his dog had died when he was 10, had died of infection after being scraped up in a snarl of rusty barbed wire. But on the late summer day, when all of them had walked up to the pet cemetery together, Judd said that his dog had died of old age and was buried there. He'd even pointed out the marker, although the years had worn the inscription away. Lewis flushed the toilet, turned out the light, and went back to bed. Something else was wrong as well, and in a moment, he had it. Judd had been born with the century, and that day at the pet cemetery, he had told Lewis his dog had died during the first year of the Great War. That would have been when Judd was 14, if he had meant when the war actually started in Europe, when he was 17, if he had meant when America entered the war. But tonight he said that Spot had died when he, Judd, was 10. Well, he's an old man, and old men get confused in their memories, he thought uneasily. He's said himself that he's noticed signs of increasing forgetfulness, groping for names and addresses that used to come to him easily, sometimes getting up in the morning and having no memory of the chores he planned to do just the night before. For a man of his age, he's getting off pretty goddamned light. Senility is probably too strong a word for it in Judd's case. Forgetfulness is actually better, more accurate. Nothing too surprising about a man forgetting when a dog died some 70 years ago, or the circumstances in which it died, for that matter. Forget it, Lewis. But he wasn't able to fall asleep again right away. For a long while he lay awake, too conscious of the empty house and the wind that whined around the eaves outside it. At some point he slept without even being aware that he had gone over the edge. It must have been so, because as he slipped away, it seemed to him that he heard bare feet slowly climbing the stairs, and that he thought, "Let me alone, Pascal, let me alone. What's done is done, and what's dead is dead." And the steps faded away. And although a great many other inexplicable things happened as that year darkened, Lewis was never bothered by the specter of Victor Pascal again, either waking or dreaming. 23. He awoke at 9 the next morning. Bright sunshine streamed in the bedroom's east windows. The telephone was ringing. Lewis reached up and snared it. "Hello?" "Hi," Rachel said. "Did I wake you up?" "Hope so." "You woke me up, you bitch," he said, smiling. "Ooh, such nasty language. You bad old bear," she said. "I tried to call you last night. Were you over at Judd's?" He hesitated for only the tiniest fraction of a moment. "Yes," he said. "Had a few beers. Irma was up at some sort of Thanksgiving supper. I thought about giving you a ring, but, you know." They chatted a while. Rachel updated him on her family, something he could have done without, although he took a small, mean satisfaction in the news that her father's bald spot seemed to be expanding at a faster rate. "You want to talk to Gage?" Rachel asked. Lewis grinned. "Yeah, I guess so," he said. "Don't let him hang up the phone like he did the other time." Much rattling at the other end. Dimly, he heard Rachel cajoling the kid to say, "Hi, Daddy." At last, Gage said, "Hi, Daddy." "Hi, Gage," Lewis said cheerfully. "How you doing? How's your life? Did you pull over your grandpa's pipe rack again? I certainly hope so. Maybe this time you can trash his stamp collection as well. Gage babbled on happily for 30 seconds or so, interspersing his gobbles and grunts with a few recognizable words from his growing vocabulary. Mommy, Illy, Granda, Grandma, Car, pronounced in the best Yankee tradition as Ka, Lewis was amused to note. Twuck and shit. At last, Rachel pried the phone away from him, to Gage's wail of indignation and Lewis's measured relief. He loved his son and missed him like mad, but holding a conversation with a not-quite-two-year-old was a little bit like trying to play cribbage with a lunatic. The cards kept going everywhere, and sometimes you found yourself pegging backwards. "So how's everything there?" Rachel asked. "Okay," Lewis said, with no hesitation at all this time. But he was aware he had crossed a line back when Rachel had asked him if he had gone over to Judd's last night, and he told her he had. In his mind, he suddenly heard Judd Crandall saying, "The soil of a man's heart is stonier, Lewis. A man grows what he can, and he tends it." "Well, a little dull, if you want to know the God's honest." "Miss you. You actually mean to tell me you're not enjoying your vacation from this sideshow?" "Oh, I like the quiet," he admitted. "Sure, but it gets strange after the first 24 hours or so." "Can I talk to Daddy?" It was Ellie in the background. "Lewis, Ellie's here." "Okay, put her on." He talked to Ellie for almost 5 minutes. She prattled on about the doll Grandma had gotten her, about the trip she and Granda had taken to the stockyards. "Boy, do they stink, Daddy," Ellie said, and Lewis thought, "Your Granda's no rose either, sweetie." About how she had helped make bread, and about how Gage had gotten away from Rachel while she was changing him. Gage had run down the hallway and pooped right in the doorway leading into Granda's study. "Attaboy, Gage," Lewis thought, a big grin spreading over his face. He actually thought he was going to get away, at least for this morning, and was getting ready to ask Ellie for her mother again, so he could say goodbye to her when Ellie asked, "How's church, Daddy? Does he miss me?" The grin faded from Lewis's mouth, but he answered readily, and with a perfect note of offhanded casualness, "He's fine, I guess. I gave him the leftover beef stew last night and then put him out. Haven't seen him this morning, but I just woke up." "Oh, boy, you would have made a great murderer, cool as a cucumber. Dr. Creed, when did you last see the deceased?" "He came in for supper. Had a plate of beef stew, in fact. I haven't seen him since then." "Well, give him a kiss for me." "Yuck, kiss your own cat," Lewis said, and Ellie giggled. "You want to talk to Mommy again, Daddy?" "Sure, put her on." Then it was over. He talked to Rachel for another couple of minutes. The subject of church was not touched upon. He and his wife exchanged love yous, and Lewis hung up. "That's that," he said to the empty, sunny room, and maybe the worst thing about it was that he didn't feel bad. Didn't feel guilty at all. 24. Steve Masterton called around 9:30 and asked if Lewis would like to come up to the university and play some racquetball. The place was deserted, he said gleefully, and they could play the whole goddamn day if they wanted to. Lewis could understand the glee. When the university was in session, the waiting list for a racquetball court was sometimes 2 days long. But he declined all the same, telling Steve he wanted to work on an article he was writing for the Magazine of College Medicine. "You sure?" Steve asked. "All work and no play make Jack a dull boy, you know." "Check me later," Lewis said. "Maybe I'll be up for it." Steve said he would and hung up. Lewis had told only a half lie this time. He did plan to work on his article, which concerned itself with treating contagious ailments such as chickenpox and mononucleosis in the infirmary environment. But the main reason he had turned down Steve's offer was that he was a mass of aches and pains. He discovered this as soon as he finished talking to Rachel and went into the bathroom to brush his teeth. His back muscles creaked and groaned, his shoulders were sore from lugging the cat in that damned garbage bag, and the hamstrings and back of his knees felt like guitar strings tuned 3 octaves past their normal pitch. "Christ," he thought, "and you had the stupid idea you were in some kind of shape." He would have looked cute trying to play racquetball with Steve, lumbering around like an arthritic old man. And speaking of old men, he hadn't made that hike into the woods the night before by himself. He had gone with a guy who was closing in on 85. He wondered if Judd was hurting as badly as he was this morning. He spent an hour and a half working on his article, but it did not march very well. The emptiness and the silence began to get on his nerves, and at last he stacked his yellow legal pads and the off-prints he had ordered from Johns Hopkins on the shelf above his typewriter, put on his parka, and crossed the road. Jed and Norma weren't there, but there was an envelope tacked to the porch door with his name written across the front of it. He took it down and opened the flap with his thumb. "Lewis, the good wife and me are off to Bucksport to do some shopping and to look at a Welsh dresser at the Emporium Galorium that Norma's had her eye on for about 100 years, it seems like. Probably we'll have a spot of lunch at McLeod's while we're there and come back in the late afternoon. Come on over for a beer or two tonight if you want. Your family is your family. I don't want to be no Budinsky, but if Ellie were my daughter, I wouldn't rush to tell her that her cat got killed on the highway. Why not let her enjoy her holiday? By the way, Lewis, I wouldn't talk about what we did last night either. Not around North Ludlow. There are other people who know about that old Micmac burying ground, and there are other people in town who have buried their animals there. They might say it's another part of the pet cemetery. Believe it or not, there's even a bull buried up there. Old Zach McGovern, who used to live out on Stackpole Road, buried his prize bull Henratty in the Micmac burying ground back in 1967 or 68. Ha ha. He told me that he and his two boys had taken that bull out there, and I laughed until I thought I would rupture myself. But people around here don't like to talk about it, and they don't like people they consider to be outsiders to know about it. Not because some of these old superstitions go back 300 years or more, although they do, but because they sort of believe in those superstitions, and they think any outsider who knows that they do must be laughing at them. Does that make any sense? I suspect it doesn't, but nevertheless, that's how it is. So just do me a favor and keep shut on the subject, will you? We'll talk more about this probably tonight, and by then you will understand more. But in the meantime, I want to tell you that you did yourself proud. I knew you would. Judd. P.S. Norma doesn't know what this note says. I told her something different, and I would just as soon keep it that way if it's all the same to you. I've told Norma more than one lie in the 58 years we've been married, and I guess that most men tell their wives a smart of lies. But, you know, most of them could stand before God and confess them without dropping their eyes from his. Well, drop over tonight, and we'll do a little boozing. J. Lewis stood on the top step leading to Judd and Norma's porch, now bare, its comfortable rattan furniture stored to wait for another spring, frowning over this note. Don't tell Ellie the cat had been killed. He hadn't. Other animals buried there? Superstitions going back 300 years? And by then you will understand more. He touched this line lightly with his finger, and for the first time allowed his mind to deliberately turn back to what they had done the night before. It was blurred in his memory. It had the melting cotton candy texture of dreams or of waking actions performed under a light haze of drugs. He could recall climbing the deadfall, the odd, brighter quality of light in the bog. That and the way it had felt 10 or 20 degrees warmer there. But all of it was like the conversation you had with the anesthetist just before he or she put you out like a light. And I'd guess most men tell their wives a smart of lies. Wives and daughters as well, Lewis thought. But it was eerie, the way Judd seemed almost to know what had transpired this morning, both on the telephone and in his own head. Slowly he refolded the note, which had been written on a sheet of lined paper, like that in a schoolboy's blue horse tablet, and put it back into the envelope. He put the envelope into his hip pocket and crossed the road again. 25. It was around 1 o'clock that afternoon when church came back, like the cat in the nursery rhyme. Lewis was in the garage, where he had been working off and on for the last 6 weeks on a fairly ambitious set of shelves. He wanted to put all of the dangerous garage stuff, such as bottles of windshield wiper fluid, antifreeze and sharp tools on these shelves where they would be out of Gage's reach. He was hammering in a nail when Church strolled in, his tail high. Lewis did not drop the hammer or even slam his thumb. His heart jogged in his chest but did not leap. A hot wire seemed to glow momentarily in his stomach and then cool immediately like the filament of a light bulb that glows over brightly for a moment and then burns out. It was as if, he told himself later, he spent that entire sunny post-Thanksgiving Friday morning waiting for Church to come back. as if he had known in some deeper, more primitive part of his mind what their night hike up to Micmac Bearing Ground had meant all along. He put the hammer down carefully, spat the nails he had been holding in his mouth back into his palm, and then dumped them into the pockets of his workman's apron. He went to church and picked the cat up. Live weight, he thought with a kind of sick excitement. He weighs what he did before he was hit. This is live weight. He was heavier in the bag. He was heavier when he was dead. His heart took a bigger jog this time, almost a leap, and for a moment the garage seemed to swim in front of his eyes. Church laid his ears back and allowed himself to be held. Lewis carried him out into the sunlight and sat down on the back steps. The cat tried to get down then, but Lewis stroked him and held him on his lap. His heart seemed to be taking regular jogs now. He probed gently into the heavy ruff of fur at Church's neck, remembering the sick, boneless way Church's head had swiveled on his broken neck the night before. He felt nothing now but good muscle and tendon. He held Church up and looked at the cat's muzzle closely. What he saw there caused him to drop the cat under the grass quickly and to cover his face with one hand, his eyes shut. The whole world was swimming now, and his head was full of a tottery, sick vertigo. It was the sort of feeling he could remember from the bitter end of long drunks just before the puking started. There was dried blood caked on Church's muzzle, and caught in his long whiskers were two tiny shreds of green plastic, bits of hefty bag. "We will talk more about this, and by then you will understand more." Oh, Christ, he understood more than he wanted to right now. "Give me a chance," Lewis thought, "and I'll understand myself right into the nearest mental asylum." He let Church into the house, got his blue dish, and opened a tuna and liver cat dinner. As he spooned the gray-brown mess out of the can, Church purred unevenly and rubbed back and forth along Lewis's ankles. The feel of the cat caused Lewis to break out in goose flesh, and he had to clench his teeth grimly to keep from kicking him away. His furry sides felt somehow too slick, too thick. In a word, loathsome. Lewis found he didn't care if he ever touched Church again. When he bent and put the dish on the floor, Church streaked past him to get it, and Lewis could have sworn he smelled sour earth, as if it had been ground into the cat's fur. He stood back, watching the cat eat. He could hear him smacking. Had Church smacked over his food that way before? Perhaps he had, and Lewis had just never noticed. Either way, it was a disgusting sound. Gross, Ellie would have said. Abruptly, Lewis turned and went upstairs. He started at a walk, but by the time he got to the upper hallway, he was almost running. He undressed, tossing all of his clothes in the laundry hamper, although he had put them on fresh from the underwear out that morning. He drew himself a hot bath, as hot as he could take it, and plopped in. The steam rose around him, and he could feel the hot water working on his muscles, loosening them. The bath was also working on his head, loosening that. By the time the water had begun to cool, he was feeling dozy and pretty much all right again. The cat came back, just like the cat in the nursery rhyme, all right. So what? Big deal. It had all been a mistake. Hadn't he thought to himself yesterday evening that Church looked remarkably whole and unmarked for an animal that had been struck by a car? Think of all the woodchucks and cats and dogs you've seen strewn all over the highway, he thought. Their bodies burst, their guts everywhere. Technicolor, as Loudon Wainwright says on that record about the dead skunk. It was obvious now. Church had been struck hard and stunned. The cat he had carried up to Judd's old Micmac Bearing Ground had been unconscious, not dead. Didn't they say cats had 9 lives? Thank God he hadn't said anything to Ellie. She would never have to know how close Church had come. The blood on his mouth and ruff, the way his neck turned. But he was a doctor, not a vet. He'd made a misdiagnosis, that was all. It had hardly been under the best circumstances for close examination, squatting on Judd's lawn in 20-degree temperatures, the light almost gone from the sky, and he had been wearing gloves. That could have... A bloated, misshapen shadow rose on the tiled bathroom wall, like the head of a small dragon or of some monstrous snake. Something touched his bare shoulder lightly and skidded. Lewis jerked upward galvanically, splashing water out of the tub and soaking the bath mat. He turned, cringing back at the same time and stared into the muddy yellow-green eyes of his daughter's cat, who was perched on the lowered seat of the toilet. Church was swaying slowly back and forth as if drunk. Lewis watched, his body crawling with revulsion, a scream barely held back in his mouth by his clamped teeth. Church had never looked like this, had never swayed, like a snake trying to hypnotize its prey. Not before he was fixed and not afterward. For the first and last time, he played with the idea that this was a different cat, one that just looked like Ellie's. A cat that had just wandered into his garage while he was putting up those shelves. And that the real Church was still buried under that cairn on the bluff in the woods. But the markings were the same. And the one ragged ear. And the paw that had that funny chewed look. Ellie had slammed that paw on the back door of their little suburban house when Church was little more than a kitten. It was Church, all right. "Get out of here," Lewis whispered hoarsely at him. Church stared at him a moment longer. God, his eyes were different. Somehow they were different. And then leaped down from the toilet seat. He landed with none of the uncanny grace cats usually display. He staggered awkwardly, haunches thudding against the tub, and then he was gone. It, Lewis thought. Not he, it. Remember, it's been spayed. He got out of the tub and dried off quickly, jerkily. He was shaved and mostly dressed when the phone rang, shrill in the empty house. When it sounded, Lewis whirled, eyes wide, hands going up. He lowered them slowly. His heart was racing, his muscles felt full of adrenaline. It was Steve Masterton checking back about racquetball, and Lewis agreed to meet him at the Memorial Gym in an hour. He could not really afford the time, and racquetball was the last thing in the world he felt like right now. But he had to get out. He wanted to get away from the cat, that weird cat which had no business being here at all. He hurried, tucking in his shirt quickly, stuffing a pair of shorts, a t-shirt, and a towel into his zipper bag and trotting down the stairs. Church was lying on the fourth riser from the bottom. Lewis tripped over the cat and almost fell. He managed to grab the banister and barely save himself from what could have been a nasty fall. He stood at the bottom of the stairs, breathing in snatches, his heart racing, the adrenaline whipping unpleasantly through his body. Church stood up, stretched, and seemed to grin at him. Lewis left. He should have put the cat out, he knew that. But he didn't. At that particular moment, he didn't think he could bring himself to touch it.